This is the Ag Market Network's monthly cotton conference call, brought to you by Cotton Incorporated and by Certified Fibermax. You can find more online at agmarketnetwork.net.
We want to welcome everyone today to the April 10th edition of the Ag Market Network's monthly teleconference. I'm Pat McClatchy, I'm the host today. Bear with me just for a minute. I need to take care of reading a disclaimer that we are required to read. Ag Market Network and its sponsors make no representations or warranties regarding the correctness of any information that it reports or the appropriateness of any transaction for any person. Speaking of our sponsors, we want to recognize our sponsors that have been with us for years, Cotton Incorporated, also Bayer Crop Science, and also Farm Press Publications. We thank them. They are the people that make this possible. I want to recognize our speakers. We're joined today by our austere panel of cotton experts, Dr. O.A. Cleveland, Dr. John Robinson, Jill Nieper, and Kip Butts. And the format for today, we'll have Dr. John Robinson give us his quick review on the crop report yesterday for cotton. And then we'll introduce our special guest speaker today, Bob Antoshak, and we'll introduce him. We'll give him a formal introduction at that time. John, thanks for starting us off and reviewing yesterday's crop report.
Thank you, and good morning to everyone. I'm pretty sure I have the easiest job this morning because the crop report yesterday was pretty much a non-event in terms of the changes in numbers. Compared to the previous month, it was a non-event in terms of really the expectation of what might change. I personally wasn't expecting that much, and we didn't end up seeing much, and there wasn't much market reaction. So I can summarize it very quickly. In terms of changes in the world numbers from USDA April as compared to the previous month, I think it's the smallest change I've ever seen in ending stocks, resulting from some offsetting things, changes in production, higher in a few places, lower in a few places, it offset. The same was pretty much true for the trade variables and for domestic use. Domestic use, I'll just mention, was a little bit higher in the latest report, but only by a little bit. But anyway, the end effect was not very much. I think 30,000 bales higher in the world numbers. That's pretty negligible. The only change on the U.S. side was one that was pretty much expected to happen sooner or later, and that was there was a little discrepancy, as usually happens this time of the year, or it can happen this time of the year, where USDA on the one hand says there's a Jennings number, which is a little bit different, bales gin versus the actual production that they're estimating in a different report, and usually those if there's a difference in any given year that's reconciled about this time of the year, it's either in the April or the May WASD. I thought they'd frankly wait till May, but they didn't, so they bumped up production to jibe with Jennings. So they bumped production up 200,000 bales pretty much, and that went to the bottom line. So U.S. ending stocks were 200,000 bales higher. Yeah, that might be, you know, that makes things a little bit heavier, but it was such an anticipated change that there wasn't, I don't think there should have been any reaction. There really wasn't any reaction. The market was kind of flat yesterday, and then it's going a little bit lower today, perhaps from that or perhaps from other things. But basically, not much of a change. I think the focus of the market is probably a little bit more on new crop, in which case the market is looking ahead to the May report, where we'll see some new estimates from USDA as far as world numbers and a more refined balance sheet. So I think we're already kind of looking ahead to, you know, wait till next year, and that'll summarize it, Pat.
Okay. Thanks for that. I'll introduce Bob Antoshak, our special guest. Bob is the managing director of Ola Inc. He manages cotton marketing, textile consulting, and brand management programs for denim and jeans company. Before Ola, he was at FC Stone Fibers and Textiles. He was there for 10 years. Bob will be speaking today about the weave of time. What will the cotton market look like in 10 years? Bob, thanks for joining us today.
Pat, thank you very much. This is a real pleasure, and thank you to everyone else, the panel, and all the listeners for your time. I certainly hope that the approach I take you will find to be interesting, and look forward to certainly discussing it with you with questions and so forth at the end. As Pat mentioned, I'm managing director of Ola. We're a denim and jeans company based in New York City. We're perhaps best known for the Kingpin's Denim Shows, which are held twice a year in New York, L.A., Hong Kong, and Amsterdam. Actually, I'll be in Amsterdam next week for one of our Kingpin shows. As I work in the textile and garment and retail end of the supply chain, I'd like to take a different approach to discussing the future of cotton between now and, say, 2025, say 10 years. Instead of looking solely at production, I'd like to look more downstream at the trends that will affect cotton over the next 10 years from the downstream perspective. And the trends that are impacting the downstream markets for sure will be somewhat different than and may appear to be a step away from the day-to-day production concerns that growers have. But they definitely, I think, again, to get a full appreciation for where cotton is and where it's going to be going, one needs to take a look at the entire supply chain in order to have a complete picture of the cotton business. I mentioned Kingpins earlier, and with that, I'd like to start with a story from Kingpins in New York. This was actually this past summer. And what I saw at that Kingpins was a bit of the future, along with some, frankly, stark reminders of the past. For one thing, I saw the director of the Better Cotton Initiative, Patrick Lane, share a discussion panel with the director of Bayer Crop Science's E3 cotton program, Brent Crossland, to describe the lives of farmers. They both were talking about the lives of farmers in developing and the developed world. Whereas just a few years ago, and this for me is what was so unique about it, whereas a few years ago such a panel discussion would have been impossible, at the Kingpins event, I really witnessed what I think was sort of a coming of the future for cotton production, a blending of technology, sustainability, and a desire to improve the lives of farmers throughout the world. Clearly, those groups were really focused on that. As recently as 5 years ago, such a discussion, if it had ever even been possible to get the two groups together, would have deteriorated into who had the greenest, quote-unquote, greenest products, fears over GMO, and a lot of tedious technical refutations. Today, it is clear that constructive dialogue in cotton is more possible than ever before, setting the stage for future collaboration and initiatives. As a supporter of cotton, I can attest that the Kingpins panel was a true event to behold, a positive development that holds great promise for the future. And then there were reminders of a painful past. Visitors who attended that seminar were textile mills, brands, and retailers. And many of the visitors were, their concerns were focused on tight margins, flat domestic sales, and woeful corporate results from the most recent quarter. Exhibitors at the show, in turn, worked feverishly to sell products made with technologies and business practices that have existed since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution. Textiles has been an old business, and it stays very consistent. We're talking mass production, unit price programs, product design, or to put it more succinctly, what's really key to the textile and the downstream markets are price, availability, and delivery. That's been in place for, frankly, centuries. In fact, despite the challenges of today's market, many buyers visiting Kingpins sought out only those manufacturers using the oldest equipment and techniques because these suppliers have the lowest prices. Buyers say look for old in an effort to stand out in a crowded market of new, and because lack of investment leads to lower cost, contemporary innovations such as sustainable production were marketed by virtually all exhibitors, along with the promise of simpler supply chains, a return of U.S. production, and above all, the value of the purchasing dollar. So I participated in a show where I had a glimpse of the future while being reminded of the past. A dichotomy for an industry struggling to exist in a rapidly changing world. For me, it's ironic, as I can see would-be cotton foes working to find common ground while buyers of today's textiles are looking to turn back the clock to a simpler time when production was crafted locally and customers were visited by car or train as opposed to a 747 jet. Supply chains have really changed over the years. Today's market, although more interconnected thanks to technology and the Internet, is actually a far more impersonal place. Sellers and buyers just don't spend the time with each other as they used to before the advent of Skype, instant messaging, and email. Today's industry is complicated, if not outright convoluted. Supply chains wrap around the globe. Consumer preferences are constantly changing. Governments advocate conflicting trade policies. Raw material costs fluctuate. Weather events compound even the most carefully calibrated deliveries. And technology impacts traditional ways of doing business. All the while, fashion continues on as an arbiter of good taste and next year's trends in fiber, fabrics, and designs. In the midst of this seeming chaos, executives struggle to figure out the next hot product, the next innovation that will secure their company's place in an uncertain future. How does one best hedge against an uncertain future? As we all know, in the cotton business, merchants develop a strategy of puts, calls, and options that provide insurance to protect against price fluctuations, or so they hope. While in the textile and garment business, costs are reduced to protect ever-thinning margins. Cost is the overriding consideration today. The market's tough, very tough. Whether it's the cost of cotton or a yarn or a fabric, garment makers struggle to find a formula that provides profit and pleases their customer, the retailer. For retailers, faced with an often fickle consumer market, low costs help to provide a degree of flexibility in meeting demand. Some people may blame Walmart for driving the industry into a ditch of low prices, but the reality is more due to a stagnant standard of living for many consumers. They really have less money to spend on clothes, as incomes for the average American have stalled in recent years. As a result, the textile supply chain looks for the lowest price, figuring out strategies to cut costs and preserve profitability. Enter China, then, followed by Bangladesh, Vietnam, and Cambodia. Low-cost producers with plenty of cheap labor, access to raw materials, and enormous garment industries. There was a time when a buyer, say in Manhattan, could easily place orders with manufacturers, let's say in Brooklyn. The Brooklyn of today is now Ho Chi Minh City, and before that it was Shanghai, and before that it was Hong Kong. Costs have fallen all the while, but the very nature of business has changed. Technology and rapid communications have replaced the number 7 train to Brooklyn. And yet, as costs overall have declined thanks to cheap labor and higher productivity in Asia and elsewhere, conducting business has only become more complicated. Moreover, as costs in China, like Hong Kong before it, have risen, new suppliers have rushed in to fill the low-cost void, not just from places like Bangladesh, Vietnam, and Cambodia, but also from places like Tanzania, Mauritius, and Myanmar. The bottom line for our industry today is just that, the bottom line. But it is also fraught with change, a constant churning of suppliers to meet the demand of increasingly stressed buyers. Where does this end? Let's take a look. Let's look ahead for 10 years ahead. It's always hazardous to predict the future, but there are some trends evident today that will likely shape the global textile industry over the next 10 years. In fact, barring some unforeseen technological development, it's always possible, or some global conflict, let's hope not, or global contagion, also let's hope not, the world of 2025 will seem like the world of 2015, only more so. For one thing, it is doubtful that people will stop wearing clothes. Although demand for clothing may grow in China and India, while demand in the U.S., Europe, and Japan may be even or slightly behind today's levels, for another thing, fiber composition will be more important than ever. If warm climate countries increase consumption of clothing, will that favor synthetic or natural fibers? Additionally, will climate change prove to be a challenge for cotton and wool producers? At the same time, would a global shortage in petroleum impact synthetic fiber production? What about prices? More so, what about the environment? When considering these daunting possibilities, I must conclude that the global textile industry of 2025 will be shaped by the following 10 factors, which I list in, frankly, no particular order. Number one, the environment. There will be more competition over a limited supply of natural resources. As a result, the green movement will become more important than ever as companies throughout the supply chain will be forced to work to find ways of using less fuel and water while producing products that require less input from the planet and polluting less. Moreover, consumers around the world will continue to demand products perceived to be cleaner and more environmentally friendly. Point two, distribution. Supply chains will become more complicated than ever. The distances required to support some supply chains will be longer as the geographical centers of production move to different parts of the world. There will always be a low-cost segment of the garment business that will always search out the lowest source of production. no matter where it is. In turn, the movement of raw materials in terms of fiber, yarn, and fabrics may come from different parts of the world, only to be incorporated into a final garment produced in a low-cost country or countries. The same may be said of dyeing and finishing. In this sense, cheap comes with the cost of complexity. Point three, communications. Tools for rapid communication will become more ubiquitous. Instant mail, email, Skype, teleconferencing, etc., will morph into even more effective means of communications, and management of far-flung supply chains will become even more efficient. Certainly, technology will play a role here, but over the next 10 years, the power of mobile devices may go to a point where traditional computer networks fall into the background of corporate computing, as extra mobility will permit better communication. And I should add that really it'll also provide an opportunity for marketers that may not be quite so present today. Point four, conflicts. Human history, needless to say, human history is littered with conflicts. That will not change in the future. If anything, social, political, and economic conflicts around the globe will only complicate global business. In part, globalization has increased cross-border exposure to problems around the world, as global integration will bring increased trade of social and political problems. In turn, global supply chains will be vulnerable to disruption. For example, what would a blockade of the South China Sea do to global trade of textiles and apparel? Or as we saw with the SARS outbreak, what would happen to supply chains if a particular region suffered through some debilitating contagion? These are awful possibilities, but very real threats to global sourcing. Point five, hemispheric sourcing. An irony of the most recent round of the global trade talks, the so-called Doha round, which many of you are familiar with, is that regional trade agreements have gained in prominence while multilateral negotiations at the World Trade Organization remain stalled. As a result, regional trading blocs have gained new importance. For example, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP, has taken on enormous significance in terms of political and economic impact. In fact, the WTO was established to help limit such regional agreements, to set a mechanism in place where regional trade deals, like the North American Free Trade Agreement or the TPP, would be superseded by a globally focused multilateral system of checks and balances. However, economic forces may ultimately win out over political considerations. Outward processing in the Caribbean, for example, has staged a comeback after years of stagnation. Why is that? Some companies wish to source closer to home for faster delivery and better quality controls, among other factors. Point six, technological innovation. A new, potentially disruptive technology will directly affect the production of textiles and garments. I do not believe that robots will replace garment workers anytime soon, but work in robotics is ongoing and will eventually affect our industry. I can envision new technologies that would permit production of some garments by consumers. In particular, 3D printing holds promise. Is it science fiction, magic, crazy? Perhaps. But there's already evidence of a breakthrough on the horizon. For consumers, the ability to print a T-shirt, say, at home from designs made available on the Internet has serious appeal and financial promise for those willing to pioneer in the field. Point seven, demographics. In the developed world, we're looking at aging populations, as well as overall population growth will increasingly play an important role in sourcing decisions. Growing populations typically translate into higher apparel sales. If population growth in the United States, Europe, and Japan slows, then apparel sales will likely decline or at least be stagnant. And that's some of what I think what we're seeing today. Then there is China and India. With so much of the world's population gathered in two countries, the importance of greater population growth takes on a new significance. Demographically speaking, India is a relatively young country, but struggles with economic growth, while China is facing an aging demographic despite its gains on the economic front. What will happen? If growth fails to materialize in these countries, then I fear aggregate global growth and consumption of apparel will suffer as a result, and in turn translate back into weaker sales for cotton. Point eight, globalization. The limits of globalization will be realized over the next 10 years. The model of globalized growth will come under increased pressure. On one level, globalization has validated the economic model of market capitalism. But on another level, globalization has helped develop countries to leverage developing countries, not in the sense of exploiting the less fortunate, but by leveraging essential economic cost advantages found in the developing world as a way of bolstering increasingly squeezed margins in the developed world. Indeed, there are only so many countries left in the world capable of building up a cut-and-sew trade like that in Bangladesh, and virtually no country with the capacity of China. In short, does globalization end at the shore of Africa? Or once Africa enters the globalized world, where does globalization move to? What's left? It ends up moving past Africa into the back to the U.S. East Coast? It's an interesting question. Point nine, inequality. An outgrowth of globalization and the expansion of market capitalism is economic inequality. Simply put, some people will do better than others. Either on balance, global trade is good for the global economy, but development remains uneven. In the developed world, a small minority of people has prospered compared to the general population, where incomes remain stagnant or have fallen. In aggregate, though, developed world economies have grown become wealthier. The same can be said of the developing countries. Places such as Bangladesh and Vietnam have directly benefited from the expansion of market capitalism. Without question, we know China has thrived in such an environment. Even so, the standard of living in the developed world continues to dwarf that of developing nations. This begs the question, what happens to apparel production? Will it be uneven? Or will it increase due to the sheer number of people needed to be clothed in the developing world? And that's a real, for me, is a very key marketing question. Is it high-value-added type production, or is it going to be just mass, lowest common unit production? And then the question comes back, does it favor lots and lots of synthetic usage for the huge masses of people who are entering the middle class now? Or are there opportunities for cotton in there? Final point is point 10, and this has to do with energy. It's hard to envision a world that does not use fossil fuels 10 years hence. Though such resources are limited and a flashpoint for conflict, concurrently the price of energy will fluctuate over time, directly affecting the price of everything from synthetic fibers to transportation. Distant supply chains could become more expensive to operate if the price of oil were to soar due to conflict or natural disasters. Nevertheless, energy remains an essential cost component for any sourcing strategy. Now, in reviewing these 10 issues, and I'll mention them again, these are key issues that are affecting the downstream markets for cotton. And I think these issues are broad, and I think these are issues that will help to give some structure to a lot of the factors that are most directly affecting sourcing decisions today and then also 10 years down the road. And, again, I summarize these as the environment will be a key factor. I think distribution, I think the supply chains are going to become it's interesting. Parts of the supply chains will become more complicated, but some of them will also become shorter. And I think there could be increased usage of, say, Western Hemispheric supply chains to meet the needs of North American consumers. Along with that, there could be some interesting shifts in terms of the availability and use of cotton in that particular mix. I think it has the potential to favor it. Communications, I think the way we've become so globalized in this business, I think in a lot of ways our own communication internationally has become a commodity in itself. I think it's just so ubiquitous now. And it's so easy to get the communication and the basic news and the basic reporting out of the markets. I think a lot of the sourcing decisions at times are done very quickly without a lot of thinking gone into it. And I think those are opportunities, again, for the cotton industry to be able to step up and provide alternatives to these downstream sourcing people. Conflicts, I think, is something that we just can't rule out, unfortunately. I mean, there could be a war that pops up anywhere. There could be some sort of political strife that pops up. And, again, it obviously would be affecting the global industry quite dramatically. As I mentioned with the supply chain point, hemispheric sourcing is something, again, I just double back around on. Hemispheric sourcing, I think, is really something we need to look at. I think there's a lot to be said for the Caribbean coming back as a source of production for using U.S. yarn and so forth. And again, I think that's something that should be encouraged, and I think that's something that's very useful. I think it also has helped to augment some of the return of U.S. production, U.S. textile production, that we've seen over the last few years. technological innovation, I take that as a given. Very interested in the 3D printing. And again, I think there's all sorts of possibilities, whether that becomes a commercially viable program or products on a wide scale, which that's yet to be seen. But again, it does lead itself to some very interesting possibilities for the industry. Demographics. I think the demographic issue is a really central one, and I think it's a key one for understanding the mix of synthetics versus cotton in the global fiber consumption markets. I think demographics, if you have an aging market, does that favor synthetics? Is it easy care that's more important? Or is cotton still something which has broad appeal for an aging demographic? At the same time, internationally, if you're looking at some of these new rising middle classes in some of these developing countries, look at places like China and India, does that favor cotton or does it favor synthetics? On the other hand, we're dealing with warmer climates. So again, there's some give and take there, I think, in terms of opportunities as well as potential threats in terms of coming from the synthetic side opposite cotton's market share. Globalization, I think, continues, but again, I think we're beginning to hit the end of what we can do. The globe is only so big. Maybe we can find another planet somewhere to extend globalization even farther, but for the moment, we're showing some signs. Clearly there's new sources of production in Africa that are popping up, but again, I think a lot of that is, again, beginning to show that we're beginning to hit the end of a lot of the truly cheapest, low-cost sources of labor and production in the world. There's only so much of it, of course, to go around. Inequality, I think, would be also a key issue. Again, I think one of the natures of a capitalist system is that you have winners and losers, and some people do better than others, and it's just the nature of living. And because of that, there's always going to be some people who will have greater means to consume. Others will have less. And I think understanding how severe that kind of economic impact or inequality will be on an economic scale will be kind of central to understanding which portions of the market would be better able to purchase certain types of products containing various fibers. Energy, I think, is something, again, it's not talked about a real lot downstream, except when people start complaining about their trucking and shipping costs, which you do hear about from time to time. But again, I think energy is always in the background, and I think that's always a key element in considering anything into the future. Again, for some of these future factors, they're all interrelated. As you can see, some are diametrically opposed. Some of the factors are big picture, where others are really small picture. As I illustrated with my example of the cotton seminar in Kingpins, new combinations of players, new ways of envisioning and executing on business will necessarily have to be developed to compete in what will only be a more competitive industry over the next few years. Despite some quaintness, old technologies will no longer work. The textile apparel industry has been around a long time. So has cotton. They have both survived societal and economic catastrophes as well as disruptive new technologies. Through it all, though, this industry has been at the cutting edge of economic and social trends. As the first rung of industrialization, this industry has functioned in the forefront of globalization, both as a beneficiary and victim, profiteer and exploiter. What remains interesting for me is what happens after this first rung of industrial development moves on. What happens to China, for example? What's left? Is it only consumerism, or does the simple requirement, the desire to wear clothes, transcend basic manufacturing? I think all these ideas are worth considering as we consider cotton's role in the future. And again, I think all these broad concepts that I've suggested will help shape the world for cotton in the future. And again, I thank you everyone for your kind patience as I ramble through this presentation, and would welcome any questions. And Pat, thank you very much again.
Well, thank you, and we do have questions. We've got a time for just a couple here. So much of our audience is from the production end, so let's start off with a question from that group. How do you believe farmers can make money selling their cotton in the future? Is there a key to getting more for their cotton?
Yes, and I think the key is educating the consumer, and I think that's going to be an essential element. I think the consumer has to be brought back into the equation, along with the sourcing companies, the retailers themselves. I think there has to be a greater emphasis put on direct promotion to the consumer. I think the consumer these days, particularly young consumers, have a less of an appreciation for the differences in fibers, what it's all about, why they should care. I think that has a lot to do with it.
Okay. One thing I'd like to also bring up, I had heard you back in the summer talking about cotton, and you made a statement that what we needed to do was to make cotton more sexy. So give us your thoughts on what that means. What does it take to make cotton more sexy?
You know, besides the obvious, one of the things I would love to see the industry do a campaign that I refer to as the blind wear campaign, blind wear test campaign. I would love to see a commercial where you had consumers put on two identical garments. They look the same, they're the same color, the same everything, but one's cotton and one is synthetic. And then in turn, you have the announcer ask, which do you prefer to wear? And then it moves into why. And again, I just think that kind of education in a very fundamental base, you know, supported by social media as part of the marketing in addition to the television and radio and so on, I think would be enormously effective with particularly the millennial generation, which is where cotton has to spend more effort and more time. And again, I think that basically, like my children, wouldn't necessarily know the difference just to look at a garment, to pick it up, whether it was synthetic or not, or it was a natural fiber or not. And what does that mean? And why are the price points different? They may ask the question where the cotton comes from, and that's okay, too. We can use that as part of the messaging as an industry. But I feel there has to be more direct interaction. There has to be things done at the consumer level that will make cotton more attractive.
Well, let me follow up with a question. Cotton has lost market share to synthetics. Do you think that will continue to be the case in the future?
No, I really don't. I think we have to take a long-term look, and fashion also plays a role. I think we clearly are in a fashion trough right now in terms of, you know, the yoga pant has really kind of carved out some market share opposite denim. We see that almost every day. I think in time, a lot of that, particularly as consumers become more familiar with how synthetic fibers perform, particularly after athletic use, I think it'll help bring people back increasingly back to basics, cotton basics. So I think there's a fashion swing that needs to occur. But I also feel that with prices as low as they are now, now's the time to do it. Now's the time to get geared up. Because, again, you're taking that economic argument, that cost thing that I talked about before, out of the equation, because all fibers are cheap right now. Now's the time to really build market share back. And I think, again, presenting the pluses and minuses of cotton versus synthetics in the marketplace will help bring cotton back.
Okay. We want to open this up to our panel, but before we do that, I want to let everybody know, I know there are more questions to ask. If you've got a question and you want to post it on our site, on Twitter or Facebook, we'll make sure Bob addresses that, a question for you. So please, if you've got a specific question for him, you know, put it on our Twitter account or Facebook account, and we'll make sure to get you an answer for that. We have many more questions than we have time, and we do need to get over and open up our panel to talk about the market. And so, Bob, just stay with us just for a moment.
Sure.
Let's open this up to the panel. Anyone that would like to either ask a question of Bob or comment on the markets. I mean, we've had such a big run-up over the last week or two, and right now the cotton market's down about 100 points. Owe, give us your thoughts. Anyone else? Gerald, John, Kip?
I'll respond in the light of the run-up that we've had. I would have anticipated the kind of, you know, we've been in a band, and every time we dip down below into the upper 50s, there's a big surge in export sales, and every time we get up to kind of where we are, there, it drops off, and until something happens to break us out of that. And as yesterday's export sales report would suggest to me, we're still in that band. So, you know, we've had this run-up. I'm kind of expecting us to just kind of keep bouncing around. We're at the upper end of the range again, and I expect us to keep bouncing around there. So, again, until something really big changes.
Well, let's ask the question, and this we always do ask the question, how low can we go? How high can we go? Give us some thoughts. Kip, Gerald, give us your thinking.
My thoughts on this, kind of agree with John. Actually, near term, we're in this band, and I don't expect us to really. We're at the top end. I fully expected us to drop off like this. I don't know how low we'll go because we are in a situation where the world is demanding a high quality cotton, and we're not. We sold a lot of that now. So now we're having to sell a little bit more of the discounts. And so, consequently, I don't know how much more we can sell, but we are looking at the potential to draw our ending stocks down just a little bit. And I'm already hearing some discussion from folks that, well, we're going to have a low area for cotton this year in relative terms. We sure can't afford a production problem from the U.S. perspective. Now, the world is still, you know, got a glut of cotton, but with that in mind, that world glut sort of puts a cap on international prices, but the U.S. can still move a little higher. I don't see that happening anytime soon. I think we're still going to be in this range, and we're going to really need some kind of sustained, perceived legitimate supply problem to get December to really move up high to high levels. Maybe we can see low 70s for a short period of time, but we're going to need to really get something to sink our teeth into to really get the market to go much higher than that, I think. Gerald, you may have a differing opinion on that.
Well, Gerald, I guess the question is, it seems like every time this year we have talk of a squeeze, and, I mean, there's certainly clear reason to have that this year. What are your thoughts on a squeeze or how high we can go?
Well, we've run up against some really tough technical resistance, 200-month moving average right around 66.50, 66.55 in that area. You had a downtrend line on the weekly chart that came through right around 66.50. So the fact that we got over that stuff was encouraging. But unless we can close out the week and the month, you know, above that 66.50 area, we're probably going to go back down. I wouldn't be surprised to see us go back down to the lower end of the trading range, into that 60 to 62 cent area, and then come back up again. It's been very difficult to move any cotton at these price levels right now. The buyers just aren't there. I don't know if it's a lack of demand right now or they're just finding U.S. prices too high, but there certainly is cotton certainly isn't moving off the shelves real fast right now. It, particularly, as Kip mentioned earlier, particularly for anything that's not a 31.3, 36, or better piece of cotton.
Okay. Any other comments or thoughts?
I was just going to say, following up Kip's statement about in the longer term, you know, the focus might be on a potentially tight production or production problem situation. It's striking me as really difficult to our situation is patchy. You know, we've got some dry areas in Texas. We've got some wet areas in Texas. We've got wet delayed areas in the Mid-South. How all that's going to play out is harder than if we've just got a big widespread drought right off the bat, you know. So it's going to be a different kind of year sizing up just the U.S. production prospects. So, you know, so we'll just have to see it all play out. But it's more complicated, it seems to me. But we'll see.
Yeah, let me just comment in that as well on that vein. We're seeing a similar situation in South Texas. You just mentioned we've had some, believe it or not, it's too wet, which is hard to believe. You hear that sort of thing in Texas this time of the year. But we're seeing the same sort of thing in Pakistan. The sindh crop is too wet there. They're not able to plant. They've got delayed plantings there. The southern part of Punjab, Pakistan prices have now, their domestic prices are at marketing year highs. I don't know if that, in fact, is going to draw a lot of cotton sales from the U.S., but it's not unlikely that they were a small buyer, on the, I think, on this report, if I remember correctly. But it looks like they may have to go somewhere right now to get some cotton. They just got the their GSP Plus rating to sell into Europe, so that's really helped their yarn markets and fabric markets. They're increasing their volume there. So that may, in fact, create a bit of a buying effort out of Pakistan. And at the same time, you know, the Indians may let more cotton go out of their CCI. Some of you fellows, either OA or Gerald, may know more about that than I do. But there is a short-term thought that, you know, it's kind of hard to believe you could have a supply problem or a potential supply problem with the glut of cotton we have worldwide. But you are getting a start to this growing season to, you know, where can this thing go? We all know the way markets take this is, oh, well, this is the way it's going to start. It only gets worse from here. But as we speak, that patchy thing that John was talking about, I see going on lots of parts of the world now. We've seen some problems even in China and some of their delayed plantings in two or three provinces.
Okay. I know OA was at the airport. We might have lost him. OA, are you there? Okay. Well, let's. We've had a good program today. Want to remind people this will be archived very shortly this morning and be on our website, agmarketnetwork.net. Want to remind everyone our next program is, we will actually have put on our site on Monday is Cotton Incorporated's weekly cotton commentary that OA does. We publish that, put it on our site on Monday morning. Hope you'll look for that. Our thanks to our sponsors, Cotton Incorporated, the Bayer Crop Science, and the Farm Press Publications. Also, our thanks to our panel, Dr. O.A. Cleveland, Dr. John Robinson, Gerald Nieper, and Kip Butts. I want to say a special thank you to you, Bob Andeshack, for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Pat.
And we hope you'll join us again this next week for our various programs. I look forward to having you. Thanks for being with us at the Ag Market Network.